WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with Sean Penn. In the new film Dead Man Walking, he plays a murderer on death row awaiting execution. It's his first role in a couple of years. He says he now prefers writing and directing to acting. He wrote and directed the current film The Crossing Guard, starring Jack Nicholson. We'll talk with Penn about movies, surfing, his father's career directing TV shows, and the hazards of fame. And guest film critic Steve Weinberg reviews Richard III. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The governor of Illinois has commuted the death sentence of convicted killer Guinevere Garcia, despite the fact that she says she wants to be executed. Rob Schober of member station WILL in Urbana, Illinois, reports.
Garcia was sentenced to death in 1992 for killing her husband. She was scheduled to die just after midnight tonight. She would have been the first woman executed in the U.S. since 1984 and the first in Illinois in 50 years. Governor Jim Edgar says he commuted Garcia's sentence not because she's a woman, but rather because courts don't usually punish comparable crimes with death. Garcia abandoned appeals last summer because she didn't want to spend the rest of her life in jail. Anti-death penalty groups, including Amnesty International, filed clemency on Garcia's behalf. Garcia angrily dismissed the groups, saying the request was cruel and she should be allowed to die with dignity. Although a public defender involved in the case says Garcia told him if her sentence were commuted, she would accept it as an act of God. For National Public Radio, I'm Rob Schober in Urbana, Illinois.
A convoy of Chechen fighters trying to come to the aid of the rebels holding hostages in a southern Russian village was attacked by Russian warplanes today. About 150 rebels are believed to have been killed. Chechen gunmen have now hijacked a Turkish ferry boat bound for Russia. 165 people were aboard, one has been killed, and the rebels are threatening to kill all of the Russians aboard if the ship doesn't depart immediately. Another senator is calling it quits. Maine Republicans William Cohen announced today that he will not seek a fourth term in office. Keith Shortall of Maine Public Radio reports.
Cohen, a moderate who has represented Maine in Washington since 1973, has indicated for months that he planned to run again. But he announced today that the recent budget stalemate crystallized his decision to pursue new challenges in the private sector.
I know this decision is going to disappoint quite a few of my supporters who have stood by me for so many years and so many difficult cases. But I hope that they will understand that this is the right decision for me and it's the right decision for Maine. I don't rule out a return to public service in the future.
His retirement makes 13 senators who have announced they won't run for re-election this year. For National Public Radio, this is Keith Shortall in Portland, Maine.
The Washington State Superintendent of Schools has announced that she has AIDS, but she says the disease will not affect her work, and she says she may even make a run for Congress. Judith Billings says she contracted the disease in the 1980s while trying to become pregnant with donor sperm through artificial insemination. Housing starts registered a sharp increase in November, up 5.7% after falling the previous month. The report was delayed by the partial government shutdown. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 4 1/3 points at 5,039 in heavy trading. In the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ Composite Index is down 3 3/4 points. This is NPR News. Fire swept through a 10-story office building in Boston's financial district this morning, injuring 8 people, including 3 firefighters. The blaze broke out on the 5th floor of the building, initially trapping office workers on the upper floors. Dozens were rescued by firefighters who battled thick smoke. NATO officers in Bosnia are reporting some snags in the implementation of the peace accord. By Friday, all sides in Bosnia are to have released their prisoners of war and pulled all forces out of a mile-wide zone of separation. But neither requirement has yet been met. From Sarajevo, NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
NATO officials have until now been upbeat in their reports on the implementation of the Bosnia peace plan. But with just 3 days to go before the first major deadline in the agreement, a NATO spokesman here today admitted all is not well. Yesterday, the Bosnian government refused to take part in a mass prisoner release coordinated by the Red Cross. If the government does not accept the Red Cross prisoner release plan by Friday, it will be in violation of a provision of the agreement. Serb authorities are also making trouble. Serb leaders last night warned again they are unwilling to accept Muslim and Croat control over the Sarajevo suburbs now held by Serb forces. The agreement mandates such a transfer of authority. And no side has yet moved all its forces out of the separation zone in areas along the former front line. The NATO spokesman said the pullout is so far about 70% or 80% complete. I'm Tom Jelton in Sarajevo.
The Supreme Court has rejected a constitutional challenge to the federal government's enforcement policy of imposing fines as punishment for television or radio broadcasts of indecent material. The justices refused to hear the challenge from a coalition of broadcasters and public interest groups, arguing that the federal communication policy violates free speech rights. Under the law, broadcasters may face penalties of $10,000 or 2 years in prison for airing indecent material. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sean Penn's performance in the new film Dead Man Walking led our film critic Stephen Schiff to describe Penn as the finest actor of his generation. We'll talk with Penn about his performance in a couple of minutes. Dead Man Walking is based on a memoir by Sister Helen Prejean about her early experiences as a spiritual advisor to men on death row at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, and how that led her to also work with the families of the victims. Susan Sarandon plays Sister Helen. Sean Penn plays the character Matthew Poncelet in the final days before his execution. Poncelet was convicted of brutally murdering a couple on Lover's Lane. He's unrepentant about his crimes and unapologetic about his racism, as you can hear in this scene between Sarandon and Penn.
Is your daddy a racist?
What kind of question is that?
We have to teach a child to hate, and I was just wondering who taught you.
I just don't like niggas.
Have you ever known any black people?
Sure I did. That was all around when I was a kid.
All around?
They lived around me.
Did you ever play with a black child?
No. But me and my cousin got jumped pretty good once.
What happened?
We was throwing rocks at them. So the next day, they wait that chance, get a hold of our bikes, tear them up.
Can you blame them?
Well, no, but look, slavery's long over. They always harping on what a bad deal they got.
The kids that tore up your bike?
All of them. I can't stand people make themselves out to be victims.
Victims?
Yeah, they all victims.
I don't know any victims in my neighborhood. I know some pretty cool people, decent, hardworking.
Yeah, I know a lot of lazy, welfare-taking coloreds sucking up tax dollars.
You sound like a politician.
What's that mean?
You ever been the object of prejudice?
No.
What do you suppose people think about inmates on death row?
I don't know. Why don't you tell me?
They're all monsters. Disposable human waste. Good for nothing. Sucking up tax dollars.
Yeah, but I ain't no victim. They gonna kill me. I'm innocent. I ain't whining. I ain't sitting on no porch going slavery. I like rebels. Some blacks is okay. Martin Luther King, he led his people all the way to D.C. Kicked the white man's butt.
You respect Martin Luther King?
He put up a fight. He wasn't lazy.
What about lazy whites?
Don't like him.
So it's lazy people you don't like.
Can we talk about something else?
The screen adaptation of Dead Man Walking was written and directed by Tim Robbins. He did some shooting on location at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. While he was there, he spoke briefly with Fresh Air prison correspondent Wilbert Rideau, who is the editor emeritus of Angola's uncensored award-winning prison magazine, The Angolite. Rideau has been an inmate at Angola for close to 35 years.
This is a screen adaptation. I understand it's a fictionalized composite.
Yes, we've changed all the names. In the book, there's two murders and two people that she counsels before they are put to death. What I've decided to do in the movie is, rather than have two endings, I've combined the murderers into one, and the stories, certain elements of each story is in the one character. So it really isn't about specifically about either one of these people, but there are elements of both of them in there.
How do you decide which elements to use to make it dramatic yet retain the integrity of the spirit of the book, the basic story?
Well, I thought the real story here was not the story of whether someone was, you know, the innocent person on death row. I didn't want to tell that story. I've seen it before in movies, and for me, it dances around the issue of whether we should have the death penalty or not. It's certainly one of the important factors in that there are innocent people put to death. But for me, the story was about what do you do? Here's the conflict. What do you do when someone is clearly guilty and perhaps not the nicest human being in the world? And if you present that to the audience, it's a lot tougher of a road for them to make their decision. And I thought the only way to do this movie was to be honest about it, and be honest about some of the characteristics of the people in her book. And I didn't want to dance around it. I didn't want to dance around that person's racism or his, he was a member of the Aryan Nation, one of them. And for me, that's ultimately, when I put it together and I cut it together, the ultimate test is whether the audience can watch this person who they might not have liked be put to death.
Director Tim Robbins in conversation with Wilbert Rideau at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. Yesterday, we phoned Sean Penn to talk about his role in Dead Man Walking, as well as some of his other work. His other films include Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Bad Boys, The Falcon and the Snowman, At Close Range, Casualties of War, and Carlito's Way. He wrote and directed the current film The Crossing Guard, starring Jack Nicholson and Angelica Houston. In Dead Man Walking, you play a racist and anti-Semite who's guilty of rape and murder. Yet, you know, we in the audience have to see him as a human being and question the morality of his execution. While you were in character, did you see yourself as a monster, or did you have to really understand what made this person a racist and a killer?
Well, I would say that first thing, you know, in your question, you're saying we have to as an audience, and I don't think there's anything obligatory on the audience's part.
That's a good point.
In all of it.
I agree with you. Right, and the film isn't like making a plea on his behalf. Right. I agree with you, yeah.
As far as the other is concerned, you know, I don't know that I see anybody as flat-out evil, and some of those you know, aspects of character you're describing, you know, tend to be aspects of ignorance and fear anyway, which is always a sympathetic, incapacity on somebody's part. So I don't tend to get too upset with it, you know, in an individual.
Right, but you have to, in a way, convey his ignorance.
That's easy to do. That's sort of just an adjustment, because we all have our areas of ignorance, some of them that we're more aware of in ourselves than others, and you just sort of apply your own areas of ignorance to whatever the particulars are of a character.
It's one of the things I really liked so much about your performance is that it's not the kind of performance where you're really trying to telegraph things or to do a lot. In fact, I mean, the things you were capable of doing were limited. You know, your hands are cuffed during most of the performance. Most of the shots are close-ups of your face. So in a way, I felt that a lot of your performance was in your eyes. There's a coldness and a potential for danger that comes across through your eyes in a lot of the performance. And also a distrust, as you said, an ignorance, a fear. Did you think of it that way, of having to communicate a lot through your eyes?
Well, you know, there's an old joke about the blind man. Did you see Joe the blind man's house? And somebody says no, and you say, neither did he. you know, I think that that to do the kinds of things that this guy's done, there is a certain kind of blindness that becomes manifested in almost a literal way. And but this part and that stuff was really provided for in the writing in this case, and so there was, you could have an awful lot of faith, I think, in the screenwriting on this, what Tim Robbins did, to not telegraph anything, to not indicate anything. It wasn't really the burden on the actors to help the director tell the story so much as to be the characters he's telling the story with. It was very it's kind of effortless in that way.
Well, for the lack of a better word, I'm going to say that your characterization gave off, excuse the expression, a vibe. I wish I could find the right word for that. But I was wondering if you were in the presence ever of someone like the character you portray in Dead Man Walking, and what you picked up from that person, what it was like to be in their presence, and what similar qualities you wanted to convey.
I suppose that I have, in various circumstances, been around people who have either done these kinds of heinous things, or had it in them to do them, or had incredible rage on this level and that sort of thing. And so I suppose you'd want to absorb some of that, whether you're an actor or you're not. And then there's also, you know, the mass media aspect of things. Things aren't so different from what we see on 60 Minutes, you know, when you go and you tour prisons. I think that you know, spending time in a prison, or in my case, having even been in jail several times, you know, I don't think that those things were a tremendous benefit. I don't think that I knew that much more because of it than a layman who would be watching some kind of documentary program on it. You see it pretty well how it is.
Yeah. But nevertheless, I mean, I know you did spend some time in the L.A. County Jail on a probation violation. Did you... Are you in a cell where you could actually see other people anyways? I mean, if you wanted to be the observer?
You'd have to be clear with me which time we're talking about.
Well, any of the times, in any of the times.
Yeah, well, I was in a Mono County jail where I had 8 cellmates. In the L.A. County Jail, my situation there was a PC unit, which is not politically correct, but protective custody.
Right.
Where you would have some contact whenever meal breaks would happen and that sort of thing. And it tended to be, you know, I was the one there who was saying to myself, am I a threat to society? Because the reason that most of the guys are particularly in that unit is because they're high-profile, high-crime guys. And so the guys that I spent some time in there with were guys that had done the kinds of things that are played out in this movie. And there is a kind of brilliant mask of denial that goes on, I think to a large degree, often believed by the perpetrator. You know, where you're talking to somebody and they're just declaring their innocence, and they, more than lying, they believe their lie.
And that's something your character does, too.
Quite a bit.
You've said that you don't really like to act anymore, that at this time in your life you really prefer writing and directing, and you did just write and direct The Crossing Guard. Yet you took this role. What was it about this role in Dead Man Walking that made you want to take it?
I guess anything that really hits you in a human way is a rare piece in Hollywood, you know. And if I always figure that if you put three thoughts in a movie, you violated the code of Hollywood movie making. And there was a couple of three and plus thoughts in this thing, and I was very moved by it. And I liked the people that I'd be working with, and the timing was good, really. It was a good time for me to get out of Dodge here. I'd been stuck in the editing room for a long time on The Crossing Guard, and I think I needed to get out and put myself in somebody else's hands for a while. I'd had everything in mind for too long.
You said that to be productive in your work as an actor was to be destructive in your life. What is it, you think, about your approach to acting that ended up being destructive, you know, counterproductive to living a good life?
I think what it really comes down to, again, it's this timing issue. The odds of getting a script that represent your own particular journey at a given time are real slim. And so the kind of areas of your mind, your heart that you're applying to this stuff, at least in the way that I find myself operating, are the same ones that you need to be searching out your own obstacles. And so I found that whenever I was doing a movie, and if it was, you know, based on whatever investment I had to make really was in an area that I'd already traipsed over in my life, or something that is gone from past observations and wasn't really connected to whatever tomorrow was needing to be investigated, then I was stopping my own life to do it. And I was hanging myself up in old thoughts. And so I just felt very frustrated by that. And on top of that, you know, whatever investment you make this way as a writer, you're doing it on your own hours. But getting fueled up as a person, and then when you're not fueled up enough to be sort of handling your own fires, and then you got to get up 6 o'clock, put on somebody else's clothes, and give it all to that, you tend not to have much energy to pay attention to your life.
Can you give me an example of a movie where you felt what you had to do for the character didn't really mesh with where your life was at the time?
Oh, I would say Name It. This one had some journeys that were similar for me. The ones I do when I've written and directed, I certainly have. But most of the time, I would say by and large, that was the case.
So where did Dead Man Walking and your own personal life intersect?
Oh, I think that, like most people, I've got my areas of wrestling with guilt, and there was something in that, I think.
So you dealing with your guilt in a way that the characters...
There's guilt. There's also this idea. Do you know that there's a songwriter named David Berwald,
mm-hmm,
who wrote a lyric that said, "Why can I never beat this rage? Why trust in anger my mistake? It was a white-hot hate that kept me driving this straight, and even love can't bring me home." And I heard that right around the same time that I read this script, and some of those themes really clicked in.
Well, you're the kind of person who has felt that at times your work was fueled by anger?
I think the thing is, for actors, is that it's got to be fueled one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on where you are that day, and if you're fueling your work with anger, then you're not, then you're not really finding a way to really, you know, relinquish the anger, except in a, you know, it's almost no different than putting it into violence or something, except that you have, because it's another artificial way of dealing with yourself.
My guest is Sean Penn. He's starring in Dead Man Walking. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Sean Penn is my guest. He's starring in Dead Man Walking. You directed and wrote the screenplay for The Crossing Guard, starring Jack Nicholson and Angelica Houston as a couple who split up after their daughter is killed. And then Nicholson becomes obsessed with taking revenge. I was wondering what connection that story had with your life. In other words, where that story came from.
Well, this is a tale I've told a bit. I mean, it's really, I had just become a new father, and there's kind of that first elation phase you go through, and then you start to recognize that you've got an Achilles heel you never had, a vulnerability to a loss bigger than anything you've ever encountered before. And there's nightmares that accompany it. And then I'd been trying to get myself to the typewriter or somewhere around this theme, and I heard about Eric Clapton's son falling out the window in New York and dying. And I guess because of the identifiability of somebody like that, it became very personal for me. And I just came to that question, you know, how do you possibly deal with this kind of a thing? And I decided to just write into that idea.
How do you think your acting experiences have affected your approach as a director?
It's hard to say, because I think that I'm much, you know, there's always been this discussion about how, you know, former actors make good directors for actors or bad ones or whatever, but that connection is often talked about. Now, I really found, both as an actor working with somebody like Tim Robbins or David Rabe, that as well as being a writer working with actors in my material, that it's really the writer-actor connection that makes a lot more sense, because actors all have such varied processes that you can't really give that much more necessarily because of your own experience as an actor. But as a writer, there's a more sort of universal application to all actors' processes, because you're dealing with all the same details. You wrote them. And so that their concerns are very clear to you, and I think that there's also inherent trust that actors have dealing with the person who wrote the material. So I found that for me it was a lot more valuable, the fact that I'd written the scripts, than that I'd been an actor in my discussions with actors.
Now, you grew up around show business. Your father wrote and directed for Starsky and Hutch in Lost in Space?
He's just a director.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he had done all the sort of hour-long serial television stuff.
Oh, what else? What else?
Oh, he's still doing it. He's still doing Matlock, and Barnaby Jones is from the past, and he did Bonanzas and Gunsmokes, and just about Marcus Welby, M.D., just about any sort of serial television show from the late 50s from the 60s in through the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Was your father blacklisted?
Yes.
And had he refused to testify to UAC, or?
He did, and he was a communist.
Uh-huh. How did your parents explain the blacklisting period when you were growing up?
Oh, I think fairly literally. You know, I mean, my dad is a kind of, speaks like a history teacher. And so we, you know, heard it from the whole use of the Red Scare for certain political advantages of people and who the individuals were, as well as particulars of, you know, the people like Kazan and those people who were really deep-pocketed betrayers of France.
What financial impact did the blacklisting have on your family?
Well, it wiped my dad out for about 5 years. He just couldn't work in the business, period. My mother wasn't blacklisted, so she went in and started working on television. And by the time he could work again, any kind of momentum he'd had as an actor was pretty well shot. And that's when he started directing. He had a friend who helped him out into directing.
I see. Did he have to work under a pseudonym at all?
No, he worked under a pseudonym as a script doctor for a while. The blacklist had first caught him out here in Los Angeles. He was a contract player at various times, the Ida Lupino and King Brothers out here, and that wiped him out of being able to work in movies. So he was able to go to New York and work on stage for a little while, and then it caught up with him there. He didn't use a pseudonym. He was able to linger on in the theater for a little while, and then it caught up there pretty heavy, and he couldn't work there either, so he started working in a plastics factory.
So did the blacklisting experience affect you politically when you were growing up?
I think my father affected me politically when I was growing up. I think he had a clear dignity about him, and is not a bitter person. And what didn't report, you know, what had happened to him with personal bitterness towards these people. It's very matter of fact. This is what happened. This is why he thought people did what they did. this is what the effects of it were. And I think that there is a kind of deep loyalty and honesty that he and integrity he has as a man that was affecting. But I couldn't specifically attribute it to the blacklist. I mean, this is he was one among many people who'd gone off, you know, just a couple of years before they couldn't work in their own country. They'd gone off and been highly decorated for fighting for their country in World War II. So that whole irony of that and the way that he still believed in the country when it was all over.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's hard to just become an anarchist when you grow up in that kind of a circumstance, because the burdens on him had been larger than those that had come down, you know, and you know, immediately touched my life. And he had somehow maintained some kind of faith. And I think today his faith in the country is stronger than mine.
Sean Penn, he's starring in the new film Dead Man Walking. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Sean Penn and talk about his early years. He's starring in the new film Dead Man Walking. And Steve Weinberg reviews Richard III. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Sean Penn. He's starring in the new film Dead Man Walking. When we left off, we were talking about growing up in Southern California. You said that what was of interest to you when you were growing up was surfing. Was surfing a social thing for you, or was it more about being alone in the water, or some
surfing
of both?
Surfing at the time was a religion. You know, it's changed a lot. Like, surfing is a great metaphor for everything else you see around us when the clothing companies came into it. And it became a sport versus some kind of an art form or a way of life. The surfing itself changed an awful lot. We'd gone to shortboards in the 70s, which made that you'd be able to be much more fluid and maneuverability in the water. And then as time went on, the short boards got shorter and they started using it very aggressively. And so now you're not seeing a surfer kind of matching a wave's energy or flow. You're seeing them try to annihilate the thing. There's the hostility of, you know, it's the hostility of the youth shows in the water.
So what did you love about surfing? You compared it to a religion.
I think it's that, you know, it's yielding. There's something, you can't be out in that big mass of water with those bumps coming in that you're taking off on without being humble. You know, it's bigger than you are, and there's no fighting that.
What did you use from your surfing years when you played Jeff Spicoli in Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
A lot of friends I knew. This was a whole culture that had just not been, you know, I feel more like a reporter in that part than anything, because that was something, I read that and I knew who that was, and the book had been written off observations of guys like this, and it was, you know, this was a dime a dozen character. They're all over the place, and they were then. They just hadn't been, you know, they're, fortunately or unfortunately, there wasn't a place for them in the popular media until then.
So, but he was a kind of surf dude type of guy that I don't think you're describing yourself as having been.
No, I was not a pot smoker, and I think that there was something directly connected between the water and the joint that made for a lot of these guys to, their shoulders crunched on in, and they had that speech quality, and a lot of it had to do with good old marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
I liked alcohol. I didn't like marijuana.
You mentioned liking alcohol. Do you like it as much as you used to?
I always have a fondness for alcohol. I don't get to drink it as much as I used to because I got two kids and I got to have some energy in the morning.
Mm-hmm. When did you decide you wanted to act? Like your father had been an actor, then directed. You loved surfing, but obviously you started acting. What was the transition?
Well, the funny thing was I just flew on an airplane with F. Lee Bailey was on the plane. And that was the transition. I started reading his books and in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I didn't know was appealing to me was sort of the drama of what he was reporting as for a criminal lawyer. And I decided that's what I wanted to be. And so
Criminal lawyer.
Right. And he'd put out The Defense Never Rests. He'd recommended a book called The Art of Advocacy, which I brought up to him. Funnily enough, the other day, and I got real into this idea of doing that. And at the same time, I wasn't much of an achiever on the grade side, and the idea of junior college and then law school and all this was not going to work out for me. And at the same time, I started making Super 8 movies, I don't know how to articulate the transition between the thinking I was going to be a lawyer and finding myself acting, but it was somewhere in that. And then I just found myself graduating high school and the pile of Super 8 movies that I directed and acted in. And I guess one doesn't naturally think they can go up to a studio and say, give me $10 million to direct a movie, so you start acting. And I went out and I started with a repertory company and then did a lot of theater for a long time and then started doing movies.
Do you think of yourself as having a particular approach to acting, or do you think of it as being more intuitive?
No, I when I hear people say you can't learn to act, then I would have to say, well, that may be true, but if that's true, then I don't know how to act, because the only thing I do is what I learned how to do. And I think over a period of time, somebody like that, you know, I do believe there are people who have a natural gift for it. For me, I think that that bit by bit, what I learned as craft is starting to become more second nature, and I'm starting to have more faith on it. But I think that there is absolutely a craft available.
You know, I've come to really believe that celebrity is very hazardous to your health in America. That fame sometimes really hurts people, and that having the tabloid press follow you can be like having the KGB on your back. But I think it's particularly hazardous when you're young and very famous, and you kind of had a double dose of that kind of fame because of your relationship with Madonna, who also became very famous. And this isn't a question about your relationship, but it's rather what it's like to be at the center of that kind of attention and what kind of effect it has on you.
I would say that everything you said is so. I think it is very hazardous. And, you know, I, I get in trouble for saying this, but I think that for me, alcohol was very useful at that time. I blocked a lot of it out. And what I was blocking out was, you know, when you're blocking out problems that are, you know, sort of real-life problems and that have some kind of area that you can actually learn something about, that their size and shape doesn't change so much. It's how willing you are to see it for what it is. Then alcohol or any other distraction get in the way of a growth that could come. But nobody's ever going to understand that dilemma. Nobody's going to ever be able to embrace fame in a healthy way. And I don't believe it anyway. And so it's really getting to a point where it becomes just so meaningless to you as a burden, an obstacle, or a need that you can kind of deal with it in a healthier way. But for me at that time, particularly because of the youth aspect of it, you know, in myself, I think that blocking it out with alcohol was a healthy thing.
You know, I think so many people find it hard to understand why it's hard to be famous because people think that they'd love to be famous. People wish that they were famous.
Well, it's better than being poor in the cold.
Right. Now, there have been, you know, a few incidents where you slugged photographers and stuff, paparazzi who are trying to, like, sneak photographs of you. Did you feel like they asked for it and that it was justified, or is it something that if you had it to do it over again wouldn't have happened?
Oh, that's a hard call. I mean, you know, I don't want to get, you know, highfalutin about it, but I don't know if any violence is ever justified. I would say that, you know, that these people did put themselves in a position of being less than people at times and, you know, have no respect for anybody's privacy or feelings, for that matter. I mean, they're just, you know, a certain crew of professional vultures. And, you know, I've been arrested for hitting somebody when they jumped out of a bush and I thought they were going to shoot me, but they had in their hand was a camera and I didn't know. You know, they'll pop out on you anywhere and do whatever it takes to do their little thing. And I think that there's an adrenaline rush that they're working on in their little game. So they're not, you don't have people saying, hey, Mr. So-and-so, do you mind if I take your picture? You have people hiding in your toilet bowl, sneaking up between your legs and saying, surprise. And sometimes you just want to flush them back down.
You spent a little bit of time in jail for, was violating parole? Do I have that right?
It was I'm not sure which time you're referring to, so.
Well, you could tell me the charges then for the various times.
Oh, I think if you're talking about the L.A. County stint, it was probation.
Probation.
Violation, yeah.
Right. So, was it 60 days?
Yeah.
What impact did that have on you?
Bored me to tears.
Were you treated like a celebrity inside?
Oh, I was treated the way that people would like to treat celebrities when they have the opportunity to, and they're the kind of people who work in these, you know, I mean, there was a decent screw or two, as it were, but mostly it's people who like to, you know, you'd be sitting on the commode, and they'd like to tap on the glass and say, look, there's Sean Penn. Relieving himself, you know. It's not pleasant.
My guest is Sean Penn. He's starring in the new film Dead Man Walking. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sean Penn. I don't know if you read this piece or not, but James Wolcott, the film and literary critic, wrote in Vanity Fair. He did a profile of you in Vanity Fair. And he wrote that there's a spot of middle-class softness in Sean Penn that he seems to be armoring himself against. He says, but that doesn't make him a sham. Actors become what they pretend, holding something of their own in reserve. Do you feel that there was any truth in that you've been... that you had a spot of middle-class softness that you seemed to be armoring yourself against?
I think I'm dominated by middle-class softness. But I would say, you know, there's a great Bukowski poem. There's a bluebird in my heart. It wants to get out, but I pour whiskey on him, and I won't let him. You know, I mean, but in jail, you're not spending a lot of time exercising your softness.
You know, but I'm wondering just too, in general, if you felt that you wanted to detach yourself from a comfortable middle class background and be more of the, you know, of the rebel or the bad boy or the hood.
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I recognize what you're talking about. And I think that there's a certain amount of that that comes with youth, period. But I think I've always been restless with, you put me anywhere, I'm restless for somewhere else. So,
You had your days of heavy drinking, and you were also friends with the writer Charles Bukowski, who was quite the drinker himself. Did you see anything in his life that made you think about the direction you were heading in?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, in terms of, like, drinking and health and stuff like that.
Health, I've always had a pretty resilient constitution, so I've never been too worried about my health. He wasn't one of these guys for whom drink was, I think, an unnecessary escape either. You know, I think that this is one of the, you're talking about softness, this is one of the most tender people I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And he really, unfortunately, got tossed into a real, real tough life. And he found some kind of consolation in alcohol and was able to function on it. I mean, he worked very well at his typewriter drinking. I can't do that. I mean, I could do it short form, but I can't write drunk. I can't really work on anything that needs my focus if I'm drunk. So we were different in a lot of ways.
Sean Penn is my guest, and he's starring in Dead Man Walking, and he wrote and directed The Crossing Guard. You're living in a trailer now. Is that the right word for it, a trailer? On the side of your home that burned during one of those big Southern California fires. I think it was a fire that took a lot of homes, right?
Right.
Did you see your house when it was on fire? Did you see it burn?
Yeah. It went right there. It went down real fast.
What a horrible feeling that must be.
Not really. I mean, there's something very liberating about a thing like that. It was clear it was going to happen. You know, I knew about 10-20 minutes beforehand, I knew the thing was going to go. So I got my dogs and pictures and videos of my kids out of the house, and the kids weren't there, so there was none of that. And all the cliches about, you know, how much worse it could have been and what real losses are come real clear to you. And so I haven't really had a bad moment about it.
Do you miss things that you lost in the fire?
Not really. I haven't even. I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and I realized I haven't still yet not even tried to catalog in my head what I did lose.
So, do you find yourself saving fewer things than you used to?
There's just not that much to save. I mean, I think somewhere down in our psyches we have responsibility to the things we haven't taken care of. There's some picture that's underneath papers in a drawer that we know that we want to save it and we ought to put it in a proper frame, and for years we don't. Well, I don't have those anymore. So I think a lot of stuff just got flushed out and life got simpler.
Did you lose manuscripts?
A couple. I had an office that was down on the coast highway about a mile from where I had the house. And the fire came licking about 8 feet from it, but didn't take it. If it had taken that, then I'd lost, all the software and stuff that I had my scripts on. I lost some books of poetry and this and that, but not too much.
But that would have hurt, though, right? If it got your manuscripts.
I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know because I lost a lot of different kinds of things, and it. Like I say, it was mostly liberating.
No, you are going to continue acting, though. I read you're taking a role as Brendan Bean in a movie directed by Jim Sheridan, who did My Left Foot.
Jim wrote it, is producing it. His brother Peter's directing it. It's something I'd committed to do years and years ago.
Oh.
It's been a long time getting all the legal stuff cleared for them to be able to make the picture. So,
uh-huh.
So yeah, no, I'm honoring an old commitment with this one.
Would you not have done it if it wasn't for that?
I don't know, because it's a wonderful piece. I like these guys a lot, but I would say that I am doing it because of that.
So you have to gain weight for this, apparently?
Yeah. It's Brendan Behan.
Did you talk to Robert De Niro about that? Because he had put on so much weight for Raging Bull.
Yeah, I've talked
to him
a bit about it, yeah.
What advice did he give you?
The thing is, things like that, you know, I'm still playing with so many of the ideas myself about this stuff that I'm harboring all the ideas people give me and everything else into my own little energy bank.
Right. Are you still writing, too? Writing and directing?
Yeah.
What's up for you next as a writer-director?
I'm on the typewriter now.
Oh, what are you writing?
Well, it's another story that I'm going to do with Jack Nicholson.
Mm-hmm. Was it interesting for you to direct him?
A great time. Great time. You can't have a better angel on your shoulder than him.
But you probably watched some of his movies when you were pretty young.
I did, indeed.
So he could be somebody who you really looked up to for a long time. Is it awkward to then be in the position of directing him?
I still look up to him. I mean, I think he's just such a fine person, you know, on top of everything else. And directing him's effortless. You know, I mean, especially on a thing like what we did, because it's, you know, any smart man, which he is, would know what this thing was and what the investment was going to be, and he wouldn't have done it if he wasn't in some place that he was ready to invest like that. And also, you know, the character is 50-something years old, and so he knows more about those guys than I do, because he is one.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really great to just see the whole thing unfold. I didn't spend an awful lot of time whispering in his ear little magic thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it wasn't necessary.
Just one more question. Your father has directed probably zillions of hours of television. Do you think you learned anything about directing from your father?
Storytelling, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I always talk to him about my scripts and all that stuff, and he tends to have an impact on them.
If you don't mind my saying this, you seem to be really kind of thoughtful and intelligent in your... You know, in your take on things and your approach to acting and directing and writing. And yet over the years, I think your media image has been as someone who's you know, who's kind of a jerk in some ways. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, it's something Bukowski said on that also, which is, I know I'm good, so let them think I'm bad. It gives me dimension.
Well,
you know, I don't care.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I do know all that stuff, but, you know, when they walk in my shoes, I'll listen.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
You bet.
Sean Penn stars in the new film Dead Man Walking. He also wrote and directed The Crossing Guard. I want to play a record that a lot of our listeners asked about when we first played it, but until now, the music was very hard to get, available in the States only as an import. It's by singer Ted Hawkins, who was a guest on Fresh Air a couple of years ago. He died 1 year ago at the age of 58. Hawkins spent much of his career singing on the boardwalk of Venice Beach, California. He made a couple of excellent records for the Rounder label, but they weren't commercial successes. In the early 90s, Sean Penn's brother, Michael Penn, a singer-songwriter, heard Hawkins and brought him to the attention of Geffen Records. Geffen released a fine record by Hawkins shortly before his death. Now, the hard-to-get record listeners asked about was recorded in 1985. Many of the tracks are re-released on the new CD called Ted Hawkins' Songs from Venice Beach on the label Evidence Music. From that CD, here's Hawkins singing Just My Imagination.
Each day through my window, I watch her as she passes by. I said to myself, you're such a lucky guy to have a girl like her. It's truly a dream come true. Out of all the fellas in the world, she belonged to me. But it was just my imagination running away with me. It was just my imagination running away with me. Soon we'll be married and raise a family, a cozy little home in the country with two children, maybe three. Oh, I visualize it all. This couldn't be a dream, cause it's too real, it all seems. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Every night on my knees I pray, dear Lord, hear my plea. Don't ever let another take a love from me, or I will surely die. Heavenly, with her arms around me, I could hear a rhapsody, but in reality, she doesn't even know me. Once again, running away with me. It was just my imagination running away with me. Soon we'll be married and raise a family.
Ted Hawkins from the new CD, Ted Hawkins, Songs from Venice Beach. Coming up, a review of the film Richard III. This is Fresh Air. Ian McKellen is the first actor to perform Shakespeare's Richard III on screen since Laurence Olivier 40 years ago. McKellen adapted the play with director Richard Loncrane. It's set in pre-war fascist Europe. Guest critic Steve Weinberg has a review.
The new film of Shakespeare's Richard III is updated to the 30s and features Ian McKellen as a fascist Richard. And for the first 10 or 15 minutes, you're likely to be wowed by the cleverness of the conception. A tank crashes through the wall of a royal suite. McKellen steps out in an oxygen mask and machine guns some prince or other. Richard's "Now is the winter of our discontent" speech is delivered at a microphone, at the height of a grand ball celebrating the supposed end of civil war.
Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried.
Lady Anne, played by Kristen Scott Thomas, whose husband is the latest casualty of Richard's lust for the throne, claims the body in a hospital morgue. That's the setting for her exchange with Richard, perhaps the most famous in the play, where he convinces her that he murdered only for the sake of her love. The director, Richard Loncrane, working off a stage version by Richard Eyre, which also starred McKellen, has a big bag full of tricks. But that's all they are. This must be the most self-conscious Shakespeare film ever made. We're cued to applaud the ingeniousness of the direction at every turn. Orson Welles did some flamboyant things in his Shakespeare movies, and the transformations in Olivier's Henry V, which began on the stage of the Globe, were far from understated. When you watch these movies, though, you feel that the plays themselves matter to the directors. Shakespeare is practically irrelevant to this Richard III. It's not the updating I quarrel with. Shakespeare is rarely performed in Renaissance dress. But the Loncrane McKellen Richard seems to be focused on the unlikely link between the physical trademarks of the fascist era, which are presented in nearly naturalistic detail, and the formal verse. It doesn't take long to notice that almost none of the equations Longcrane draws between the text and the setting is dramatically very interesting. For instance, he gives Anne a drug habit. Didn't Peter Sellers already try this in Don Giovanni? And he makes such a big deal out of this invented hybrid style that you stay distanced from the world the movie wants to create. McKellen manipulates the verse deftly, but his performance isn't a take on Richard. It's grounded in theatricality, not the script. He's surrounded by a high-profile supporting cast, mostly Brits with a few Americans tossed in. But neither Annette Bening as Queen Elizabeth nor Robert Downey as her brother Rivers shows any confidence with the language. It's especially depressing to watch Downey, an amazing physical clown, swimming hopelessly against the tide. The only performances I enjoyed are given by the impeccable Jim Broadbent as Richard's cohort Buckingham, and by Maggie Smith in a severely truncated version of the role of old Margaret, the Queen Mother. Except for their contributions, the movie's a game, a conceit, and not amusing for very long.
Steve Weinberg writes for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at College of the Holy Cross. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Barbara Bogave. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.